You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent this morning. And between 1954 and 1959, some 22,000 workers moved more than 200 million cubic yards of earth, poured more than 6 million cubic yards of concrete to build one of the engineering marvels of the 20th century. The St. Lawrence Seaway stretches almost 200 miles from Montreal to Lake Ontario. According to the U.S. Department of Transportation, today the Seaway system supports almost 240,000 jobs and $35 billion in economic activity annually. Our first guest this morning will now be overseeing it all. Adam Tindall Schlicht is the administrator for the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway Development Corporation. He was appointed to the post earlier this month. Tindall Schlicht was previously the director of the Port of Milwaukee. And Adam, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Morning, and I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about what you're taking from the Port of Milwaukee and how that will lead to the priorities you bring to your new position as the administrator for the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway Development Corporation.
Well, I just have to say I'm so excited for this opportunity, and leading Port Milwaukee as director really was one of the highlights of my career. It would have taken the rarest of opportunities for me to leave that job, and certainly becoming administrator of the U.S. Seaway is that opportunity. As port director, we really focused on expanding multimodal commercial and passenger operations in Milwaukee, and I'm looking forward to that focus as Seaway administrator, certainly through the lens of coastal resiliency and sustainability.
So tell us, in no uncertain terms here, what does the St. Lawrence Seaway system mean for Wisconsin?
The Seaway is North America's foremost maritime supply chain, providing Wisconsin ports, large and small, like Milwaukee, like Green Bay, like Superior, with that global connectivity. It's an essential trade corridor that has operated with almost 99% efficiency since 1959. I'm thinking about imports of specialty steel and heavy equipment that bring in those cargoes for our construction projects statewide. I'm thinking about exports like corn, soy, wheat, and other grains that are grown by Wisconsin farmers, having ready access to global markets. It really has been that critical maritime artery for our commercial ports, large and small, throughout the state.
Adam Tindall Schlicht joining us. He is the new administrator for the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway Development Corporation. And I saw on the PBS NewsHour last night the story about the drought along the Mississippi River taking its toll on harvest season, and U.S. grain export numbers in the Great Lakes have gone up as a result. The Seaway saw a roughly 25% increase in grain shipments year over year. So how important is this Seaway for overall global trade and local trade?
We are heading into the last month of the international shipping season in 2022 with a great deal of enthusiasm. We are seeing, again, that sustained 25% increase of exports of U.S. grains. And I think we're going to see that right till the end here through December. A lot of capacity exists. And I will add that point about the Mississippi is quite timely. When we look at agricultural export trends in North America, in those times when the Mississippi River has a bit of a slowdown, you do tend to see an increase in export activity through the Seaway. So there's a lot of enthusiasm as we close out what has been a very successful season for the Seaway thus far.
And Adam, what about environmentalism? The U.S. and Canada has launched an initiative earlier this month to establish a green shipping corridor for the St. Lawrence Seaway system. So what's behind the effort to prioritize more environmentally friendly shipping?
I am so excited to be joining the administration and to be carrying out the Biden-Harris administration's vision for this green shipping corridor on the St. Lawrence. The president said at COP in Egypt that good climate and environmental policy is good economic policy. And I think that's going to be one of the key tenets of my work as administrator at the Seaway, making sure that we're not just acting as a robust economic artery for vessel activity into and around the world, but making sure that that focus on stewardship, on decarbonization, on electrification is going to be some of those pivots, those plans that we're going to be able to put in because of this really exciting announcement made by both the U.S. and Canadian governments.
Well, how does that environmentally friendly translate to economically friendly, Adam?
I think the connection is resiliency. And I go back to my work as port director. As your listeners will well know, the Great Lakes have seen a dramatic influx of water moving from historic highs to historic lows over the last 10 years. And I think the connection between environmental policy and economic policy is resilient infrastructure. That's economic resiliency. That's environmental resiliency. Making sure that we are using the generational opportunity of both the bipartisan infrastructure bill and certainly the Inflation Reduction Act and a lot of the funds that are available there for infrastructure projects, partnering with Great Lakes Ports, both U.S. and Canadian, to bring in that infrastructure planning that is resilient to the effects of climate change and really trying to provide incentives for our system users, ship owners, beneficial owners of cargo, to continue making what has been millions of dollars in environment-centric related investment for those vessels that utilize our seaway system.
Hey, Adam, I want to thank you for joining us this morning. We've got Senator Baldwin coming up next, but congratulations on your new post.
And I'm so excited for this historic announcement. And our senator did so much work. I will say, as the first openly gay Seaway Administrator, Senator Baldwin has been a champion of my career, a champion of Wisconsin's economy, and of course, equity for all people. A really great day. Thank you for the opportunity.
Adam Tindall-Schlicht, Administrator for the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway Development Corporation. Senator Tammy Baldwin joins us next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn. And on Wednesday, the U.S. Senate passed the Respect for Marriage Act with the support of all 50 Democrats and a dozen Republicans. The legislation aims to protect same-sex and interracial marriages under federal law. It follows the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling this summer on abortion that raised questions about the footing of other legal precedents established by the High Court. You can join us this morning, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us this morning, ideas@WPR.org. We have U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin on the line. Senator Baldwin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's a delight to join you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so how did Democrats convince 12 Senate Republicans to vote ultimately in favor of the Respect for Marriage Act this week?
Well, I have to say it's a little bit of a long story. But there have been a number of Republican senators who came out in favor of marriage equality a few years back. And that was really the starting point. When the House of Representatives passed the Respect for Marriage Act in July on a strong bipartisan basis, I remember immediately approaching Tom Tillis and Rob Portman and Susan Collins and said, look what they just did. We could do this too. And they were, Republicans who were on board early. And we all kind of fanned out and started connecting with Republicans who really want to get to yes on this issue, but may have had some questions or concerns. And we've worked really hard with those Republicans to come up with a substitute that I think addresses their questions and concerns and provides some clarification, but gets the job done. So that that vote earlier this week gets us onto the bill, and I feel that following Thanksgiving, we will be able to pass the Respect for Marriage Act into law.
So, yes, it now goes back to the House for a vote again as the Religious Freedoms Amendment was added, as I understand it, in the Senate bill. So the House has to pass it again. There will be a reconciliation. But you do believe that we will have this bill signed into law before the 2023?
I do. And just to clarify, the Senate has not added the substitute language yet. We're just onto the bill right now. So okay. Following Thanksgiving, we'll take some additional actions. And as you just said, send it back to the House and hopefully directly to the president's desk from there.
Senator Baldwin, the same-sex marriage protections already existed under the 2015 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Obergefell v. Hodges. But how would this legislation further solidify those protections and make them permanent?
Yeah, you know, if you think about the time before Obergefell was decided, what Obergefell did was basically strike down state and federal laws or constitutional provisions banning same-sex marriage. If you got rid of or reversed Obergefell, we would have a patchwork of laws across the United States. A state like Wisconsin, which in 2006 passed a constitutional amendment defining marriage as a relationship between a man and a woman, Wisconsin would be one of those states where marriage equality no longer existed. And at the federal level, we have a 1990s law, the Defense of Marriage Act, which would end federal recognition of marriage. So really what the Respect for Marriage Act does is sort of clean up these state and federal laws banning same-sex marriage, and provides that should Obergefell be overturned, that any current legally valid same-sex marriage or interracial marriage would be deemed valid by the federal government in any other state. And prospectively, as long as you married in a state that recognized marriage equality, your marriage would be recognized throughout the land.
We're talking with Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin about the Respect for Marriage Act, which passed the Senate earlier this week with bipartisan support. And we have a phone line for you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Do you expect legal challenges after the passage and signing into law of the Respect for Marriage Act? And if so, what have you done to defend this bill against future legal challenges?
So I do not expect any sort of legal challenge. In a sense, Obergefell is there. I'm sorry, the Respect for Marriage is there as an insurance against someday having the Supreme Court revisit and overturn the marriage equality case or the interracial marriage case, Loving versus Virginia. The reason behind needing this protection is that in the Dobbs case that overturned Roe versus Wade, a precedent of nearly 50 years, the legal footing, as you described earlier, underpinning the Roe versus Wade decision back in 1973, it's the same legal reasoning that got the court to decide to its decision in Loving and Obergefell and a number of contraception access cases. All of those cases were decided basically on the same legal footing. If that footing is no longer stable and the court overturned Roe versus Wade, there are a lot of folks across the United States going, oh my gosh, what's next? It sent a shockwave literally through the nation. And so the Respect for Marriage Act is really there to protect marriages that are valid right now in the event that the Supreme Court were to visit either the Loving case or the Obergefell case.
Senator Baldwin, Wisconsin Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson voted against the legislation, and following the vote, the senator cited concerns the legislation provides insufficient protections for people's religious freedoms and, quote, leaves a lane open, end quote, for discrimination. What would you say to him?
Well, I would say that he should pay close attention to the many religious institutions and organizations that have endorsed this legislation. For example, the religiously associated colleges and universities were consulted from the very beginning to make sure that we were wording the substitute legislation very carefully, having the intended consequences. The legislation has been endorsed by the Seventh-day Adventist, the Church of Latter-day Saints, an evangelical association, and a number of other organizations. So I'm confident that this amendment that I helped draft does exactly what it's purporting to do, that it won't take away or alter any religious liberty or conscience protections.
I have an email here from Matt in Madison, who's wondering if you're concerned that Republicans would consider a bill that bans interracial marriage now that we know they're expected to take over the majority of the House in the next session.
Well, the issue of interracial marriage is very similar. As I said, Loving versus Virginia was a case that was decided on the basis of the Equal Protection and Due Process clauses of the 14th Amendment and its liberty provisions, as was Obergefell. At the time that Loving versus Virginia was decided in 1967, there were still 16 states in the United States that had laws banning interracial marriage. It took until the year 2000 for the final of those states to take that statute off its books. If Obergefell were reversed today, there would be some 35 states in the United States that either had a constitutional statutory ban on same-sex marriage or both. And so you can see that probably the further we go after Obergefell, which was decided in 2015, I hope we'll see states take up and repeal their statutory prohibitions. But that's not the lay of the land right now. And again, Wisconsin, a fine example of that, sadly, in 2006, Wisconsin voters voted in a definition of marriage as being between a man and a woman. And that would be the law of Wisconsin should Obergefell be overturned.
Senator Tammy Baldwin, our guest, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or Madeline and DePere standing by. Madeline, good morning. You're on the air with Senator Tammy Baldwin.
I guess I'm sort of in favor of the legislation, except that I'm a little concerned about something put in there that doesn't allow for polygamy, and also for old men marrying underage girls that aren't even old enough to make their decision. I think the wording needs to be very cautious.
Madeline, thank you. Does the bill have any influence on the age of marriage or polygamy, Senator?
On the former, no. Those are issues left up to the states. But it does actually expressly ban federal recognition of polygamous marriages at the request of the Church of Latter-day Saints. Who very much wanted to use this legislation to express clearly that a marriage is between two individuals.
And the Church of Latter-day Saints has been supportive of the Respect for Marriage Act, is that correct?
Yes. First of all, have been very collaborative in the negotiations around drafting the religious liberty substitute amendment. And ultimately, I think as a result of having great input, has endorsed the measure.
And finally, Senator Baldwin, what's your feelings after Wisconsin Democrats failed to unseat Ron Johnson and lost a seat in the House in this election?
Well, I would say that overall, Democrats prevailed nationally. The expected headwinds against the party in power in Washington, D.C., the party of the president, those headwinds did not develop. And we were expected to lose control of the United States Senate. At this point, we are still tied, but it's quite possible that when the runoff in Georgia occurs, we might even be up one seat. And gubernatorial races throughout the country turned against those who were election conspiracy theorists and election deniers, and those who held more extreme views. I think Governor Tony Evers' victory in Wisconsin is proof of that. But the headwinds that were supposed to be the story of the day simply did not materialize.
Senator Tammy Baldwin, thank you as always for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Tammy Baldwin, Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, first elected in 2012. Up next, the trial, the conviction, and the sentencing of Darrell Brooks Jr. and what comes next for a community that is looking to heal. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent today, and now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about hunting and family just ahead of the gun season opener tomorrow.
For many Wisconsin families, hunting is an annual tradition rooted in customs and love. But what happens when those traditions are disrupted, when members of that deer camp are no longer with us? Ron Weber shares his experience with this in A Hunt to Remember.
There was no doubt about it. I was lost. In 35 years of hunting the Shawamigan National Forest near Clam Lake, I had been turned around many times, but never lost. Earlier that morning, I said goodbye to my older brother Rick and Terry, a longtime deer camp compadre. Their departure left me the sole occupant of the small cabin on the crooked shores of Lake Namakagan. Just 3 years earlier, it had been its usual cluttered self as we gathered for those 9 special days in November. As that season unfolded, none of us could have conceived that this would be the last time we would all meet here, and that for this deer camp, it was the beginning of the end. For my brother Jim, next season never came. In April, he was diagnosed with lung cancer, and by November was too weak to make the pilgrimage to deer camp. Jim's absence hung heavy on everyone's mind and heart. As we closed camp, none of us were thinking about next season. Jim passed away just after Christmas. I wasn't sure if the pain would be healed by the next season. We never got a chance to find out. In September, just as Mother Nature dusted off her palette of crimson and orange to paint the shoreline of the lake, my brother Gary was diagnosed with a tumor on a major blood vessel in his lung. After he left Tuesday morning, there was a pall over the camp the rest of the season. It was understood by all that deer camp would never be the same. Gary passed away in early December. With the heart and soul gone, a couple of the usual campmates did not come for the next season. Now with Rick and Terry gone, I was on my own, and I was truly lost. Like my two brothers, my mentors, my best friends, deer camp was dead. Driving to camp the Friday before the next opening day, I still wasn't sure how the season would unfold. Without the others in camp, I knew I would be hunting with ghosts, but I was not ready for the haunting quiet in the cabin. Like most nights before opening day, sleep did not come easy, but it was not because of the excitement of the moment. It was that discontenting quiet. Opening day was pleasantly uneventful. I saw the usual denizens of the woods, red squirrels, blue and gray jays, ravens, but no deer. Sometime during the day, however, I found my compass. I knew what I had to do. Each day I would choose a different area to hunt. Over the rest of the season, I would be able to make it to the places where we had hunted most and where the trophy memories and good times lay. It had come to me in the solitude of opening day that to go forward, I had to go back. There were goodbyes that needed to be said. What a season it was. I sat in Jim's stand south of Lake Ree, where he had shot several bucks, including a hefty 11-pointer. Then Porcupine Lake, where I pushed a 10-pointer to Gary, his buck of a lifetime. At every spot, I thought, I smiled, I laughed, I cried, I remembered. The last morning of the season, I was up early. Walking in the pre-dawn darkness, I could again sense that feeling of excitement which had been missing. I knew I was no longer lost. Over the course of the morning, I sat, I listened, I watched, I tracked, I hunted. As I walked out of the woods just before noon to close camp, I couldn't help but notice that though there was that familiar sadness the season was ending too soon, I was already looking forward to next November.
Ron Weber is an author and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, on to reflections of the Darrell Brooks Jr. trial, where a jury found Brooks guilty 3 weeks ago, sentenced earlier this week to six lifetimes behind bars, consecutively served, all from the six dead and dozens injured after Brooks drove his SUV through the Waukesha Christmas parade last year. Here's Waukesha County District Attorney Sue Opper at a news conference following the verdict.
There is much healing ahead for the victims and for our community, but we hope today's result is a step further along that path.
We welcome your thoughts on how Waukesha is moving forward and reflections on this trial. Join us at any time, 1-800-642-1234. What are you feeling this morning? 800-642-1234, or email us ideas@wpr.org. Our guest, Quinn Clark, community reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Quinn, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, would you take us through the sentencing earlier this week, the impact statements that were made and the impact they had on the judge's decision for the sentence?
Sure, yeah. So on Tuesday, about 40 people had impact statements prepared, either to be read in court or they were reading them there. Everyone kind of took the chance to finally be able to say how they felt during. I think that we've kind of come to a consensus that Brooks has spoken a lot during this trial and he's had a lot of time to speak, especially representing himself. So people were able to have that chance to finally say, this is how I was impacted. And they were also able to highlight, yes, this happened a year ago, but sometimes it feels like it happened yesterday because of the recurring nightmares and PTSD and injuries. So it really showed that it's a long lasting impact and it's far from being over and far from not having an impact on the Waukesha community anymore.
Yeah, how did that hit? What did it feel like to hear those? I mean, it was overwhelming.
Right. I will say, I think that I did have to step out of the courtroom after Sherry Sparks, Jackson Sparks' mother, read her impact statement because she revealed that not only is she missing her 8-year-old son who passed in the tragedy. Her son, Tucker, suffers with survivor's guilt because he feels he could have done more to protect Jackson from being hurt in the parade. So just hearing that really hit me hard. And I don't think there was a dry eye in the courtroom.
Except for perhaps Darrell Brooks Jr. What was his reaction to these impact statements?
Yeah, that is a good point. He definitely was rolling his eyes a couple times, just sarcastically clapping after some people's statements. And he also was reading his Bible too during, so it didn't look like he was actively listening. And it was a little shocking to see the rolling his eyes. I wasn't sure if he meant to do it at first, just because of how shocking that kind of reaction is to those emotional statements. But he did not seem like he was really actively listening at all.
Quinn Clark, our guest, community reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and then take us to the judge issuing the sentence to Darrell Brooks Jr., which amounts to, as I understand it, more than 1,200 years behind bars as it now stands.
Yes, that's correct.
Tell us about the judge here.
Yeah, so during her final remarks, I think that it became a really emotional full circle moment. At times, she spoke directly to victims that were in the gallery, like Tyler Pudliner, a student in the Waukesha South marching band that was very badly injured in the parade attack. She told him, you know, you are a phoenix rising from the ashes, and said to his mother, clearly you have a phoenix for a son. She called out the extreme dance group and said, thank you to the coach for your emotional testimony and your impact statement. So people felt that personal connection to the judge before she gave her sentencing. And again, a very emotional moment. And when she did read off the sentences for those who died in the attack, the six deceased victims, the gallery erupted into applause for each. And she did allow that for those sentences. So it was a full circle moment and very emotional.
The judge became emotional at one point too, didn't she?
Yes, she did. And I can't blame her for that. As much as, you know, reporters, for example, they do try to remain, you know, neutral. It was really hard not to show emotion when, especially thinking about Tucker and Jackson Sparks.
Quinn Clark, our guest, community reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who covered the trial of Darrell Brooks Jr. And we welcome your questions, comments, your feelings and reactions this morning. Whatever we take to get to healing, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, where Tony in Sturgeon Bay is standing by. Tony, good morning. You're on the air with Quinn Clark.
Morning. Good morning. I watched a lot of the trial online streaming, and I just wanted to commend Judge Doral for her courage, because she was so battered by the defendant, and it was like watching domestic violence played out on live TV. And she really stood her ground and was patient and I think doggedly determined to make sure that this case did not end up being overturned in the appellate court. So she extended the defendant so many liberties that were, you know, just beyond comprehension. But I think she did a fabulous job. And this was probably the high point and yet the low point in her judicial career.
Tony, I appreciate the perspective. And Quinn, the defendant represented himself at this trial. What defense did Brooks present to the jury, if any?
Brooks attempted to try to make people question how detectives and how people were 100% sure that it was Brooks behind the wheel, if they were sure there was no one else in the SUV. He just was attempting to create some doubt within the jury. And then I'm sure if anyone who was watching could say that he was disrupting Judge Doral and disrupting the trial as much as he could in order to prolong it and cause either a mistrial or cause being able to appeal the case afterwards as much as he could.
How would repeatedly disrupting the proceedings lead to any sort of opportunity for appeal for this defendant?
He was trying to create disruption and chaos to the point where he was trying to make Judge Doral, the prosecution, create any kind of slip up that he could later call out on. You know, I didn't get the chance to say this, or they didn't tell me the grounds for this objection. So I think he was just trying to create as much doubt and confusion as he could.
We're talking about the trial, the conviction and sentencing of Darrell Brooks Jr. He was found guilty 3 weeks ago and earlier this week sentenced to six consecutive lifetimes behind bars for his attack on the Waukesha Christmas Parade last year. Journal Sentinel reporter Quinn Clark has been covering the trial, and she joins us along with your questions and comments, whatever you're feeling this morning, at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The judge removed Brooks from the courtroom numerous times. His case put a spotlight on bail practices in our state, became part of the politics leading up to the election, and may have highlighted some gaps in our criminal justice system. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234. Our conversation continues here on The Morning Show. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn. Waukesha County Judge Jennifer Darrow allowed Darrell Brooks Jr. to act as his own attorney at trial, where juries convicted Brooks on all counts for the Waukesha Christmas Parade attack. The six victims ranged in age from 8 to 81, and Darrell Brooks has been sentenced to more than 1,200 years behind bars. And there's still time to talk about the tragedy and what you took from this verdict at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Quinn Clark stays with us. And Quinn, what stays with you from this trial? Where does the healing go from here? Where is Waukesha as a community this morning?
I think after the tragedy, people had the opportunity to attempt to heal in any way that they could by the community coming together and supporting one another. But unfortunately, the trial and all of the national attention that has been brought to it has really brought up old wounds and made things more fresh. So I think after this trial, this is when the real healing can begin. Speaking to business owners in downtown Waukesha who witnessed the SUV hit people and witnessed, the wreckage of the parade attack, they remember it like it was yesterday, and they remember things like cleaning victims' blood off of their shop windows. So I think that this is when the real healing can begin, because this national attention will begin to die down, and they know that Darrell Brooks doesn't have any chance to leave prison.
Yeah. Let's listen to Waukesha County Assistant District Attorney Zach Wichow during the trial's opening arguments here.
It sounds corny, but I think you'll see from the videos, there was a true sense of joy in the air. Darrell Brooks killed that joy. Replaced it with terror, trauma, and death.
Quinn Clark, how did the prosecution go about making its case against the defendant?
I think that the prosecution created a great and trustworthy relationship with victims of the tragedy. A lot of victims mentioned how much they appreciated the prosecution and how close they became with them. So I think that they created a lot of trust, and they just showed the details as they were. This is a community in mourning, and this is many, many people with lasting impact from this. So I think they just appealed to human emotion, and they didn't get too technical about, where was Brooks during this time and where was the vehicle during this time to prove that there was another that there wasn't another person in the car. Yes, that was a part of the trial. Yes, they did look back at security camera footage, and yes, they did speak to detectives. But a large part of this was just showing this is a community in mourning, and this is a really lasting impact on people who lost loved ones, and those who were injured are still dealing with those injuries today.
And before the trial, Waukesha County Circuit Court Judge Jennifer Darrow warned Brooks about outbursts after several in the pretrial hearings. Here she is.
At trial, what's going to happen if you continue to do that is you will be admonished in front of the jury.
That's fine.
If you continue that.
That's fine.
Quinn, how about Brooks's representation of himself? How about his defense? What stuck out for you?
What definitely stuck out for me is that he was able to confidently cross-examine people that he hit with a U.S. SUV and just seemed to show absolutely zero remorse. That is something very jarring to witness. Especially when someone is on the stand talking about their injuries or talking about their loved ones being severely hurt, and then he cross-examines them directly after. I also think it's notable that he also attempted to create some doubt that he was abusive to his ex-girlfriend. Cross-examining her and also calling her to the stand just showed that he really does not take accountability for his actions.
Did he show any remorse? Did he ever offer an apology of any kind?
During his very final statement before Judge Darrow sentenced him, he began an apology, which I was surprised to hear. He said, "I am sorry to the community But he quickly followed that by saying, but I'm also sorry that you don't see all the tears that I've cried and you don't see how much I've prayed. And he immediately turned it back on himself, pretty much voiding the apology. He also said sorry to his ex-girlfriend, and he quickly followed that by saying, it takes two. So there were no sincere apologies there.
We're talking about the Waukesha Christmas Parade tragedy and the trial of Terrell Brooks Jr. with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Quinn Clark. And Quinn, what's the testimony that you will not forget from this trial?
I think the testimony that the first day I was covering the trial, I did have a colleague also there with me, and we switched off sometimes. But when I was there, I will never forget one of the dancing grannies. She spoke about her relationships with the other dancing grannies and the ones that were murdered in the attack. And just thinking of the innocent act of those grannies coming together, driving to practice every day, and working so hard on that routine just to bring joy to the community, for this to happen, it's just, it will really stick with me to think about that, that kind of juxtaposition between an innocent act of them practicing a dance and performing, and then the car just plowing through.
Tell us what happens next in this case. Do we expect appeals from the convicted, and what are you following up on?
I think I want to give the community a break and let them heal for a little bit. They've been really, they've been spoken to by the media a lot, and they've been under a lot of stress. I just want to give them the chance to relax for a second. I think that if Brooks does file for appeal, there's absolutely no chance that anything will come out of it. But currently he is facing charges in Milwaukee, still in trial, for his domestic violence against his ex-girlfriend. So he is still doing that, and I'm not currently covering that trial, but I hope that Waukesha has the time to heal and not be under the eyes of the media for a little bit.
Hey, Quinn, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Quinn Clark, community reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she covered the weeks-long trial of Darrell Brooks Jr. in the Waukesha Christmas Parade tragedy, culminating with a sentencing earlier this week, which saw six consecutive life sentences for the defendant. And as Quinn mentioned, there may be appeals to come, but those may be difficult hurdles ahead for the convicted. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.